This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morgan.
This podcast interview is sponsored by Bruker Deltonics, the leader in CBRN detection. For more information, visit www.bdal.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Admiral John Aguinoldi, the Assistant Secretary for Health here at the Department of Health and Human Services. Admiral Aguinoldi is the highest-ranking officer in the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, and in addition to overseeing the USPHS, he serves as Secretary Leavitt's primary advisor on the nation's public health. His particular focus in the last year has been on pandemic flu preparedness and planning, and that'll be our primary topic for today's discussion. Dr. Aguinoldi came to HHS from Florida's Department of Health, where he held the position of Secretary of Health and State Health Officer for 4 years. Dr. Aguinoldi, it's great to be with you, and thank you so much for letting us join you for a time here at your headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, John.
Well, let's open our conversation with an update on the Commissioned Corps. The U.S. Public Health Service deployed more than 2,000 commissioned officers to the Gulf region before and during and after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Would you tell us what they did to support the state and local officials during those events?
Well, they made me very proud. The average citizen doesn't realize that there is a fully active duty uniformed service called the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. We've been around since 1798, but because we work so quietly in the background, most people aren't even aware that we're here. Mm. During Katrina, there was a great example of the strength of this uniformed service. There are 6,000 of us that serve in uniform, including the Surgeon General of the U.S. Public Health Service that everyone mm-hmm. probably knows. And we all wear the same uniform, and we fight against disease mm-hmm. using syringes and stethoscopes and our clinical skills to help our citizens and sometimes abroad to help others. During Katrina, 2,000 of our officers deployed into shelters. In fact, we deployed to people's homes to try and help those that were medically fragile. We deployed into hospitals and into emergency rooms where we worked alongside local providers in trying to make sure that everyone was healthy and that everyone got the care that they needed following the tragic and devastating storms of Katrina and Rita. Mm-hmm. Every day around this nation, somewhere in this nation, and indeed abroad, Afghanistan, Iraq, and in other nations, our officers in uniform are fighting for the health of everyone.
Mm-hmm. Now, since then, you've increased the number of the officers by 10%. So now we're at, what, 6,600 members?
Yeah, we haven't gotten all of our increase into active duty, into uniform yet, but we're in the middle of the process. Mm-hmm. We, as I've said, have 6,000 officers today and are actively recruiting mainly clinicians, physicians, mm-hmm. nurses, pharmacists, and others into the uniform service of the Commissioned Corps, even as we speak, our mm-hmm. goal being, as you state, 6,600 in the not-too-distant future.
Now, you've also improved the response operations and the team-oriented deployment process. Would you tell us a little bit about that and how that affects the interfaces with the state and local emergency preparedness agencies? Those are our primary subscribers.
So absolutely.
That interests them.
When we're not out there fighting emergencies, whether that be a disease outbreak like a pandemic or some other disease or the aftermath of a major natural event like Katrina or an earthquake. We were involved in the tsunamis as mm-hmm. well out in the Pacific. When we're not doing that, we're actually serving the public by working in many other settings, mm-hmm. like in the Indian Health Service and the Bureau of Prisons, where we offer basic clinical services to special populations. We're scattered across the nation today providing public health services and primary care.
Mm-hmm.
We realized following Katrina that although we deploy very well, although we deliver wonderful services, that we can improve just like anyone else. And so now we're moving towards a much more unit-based response where we pull teams of people together that have special skills. For example, we have mental health teams. We've pre-assembled them, we pre-trained them, and they'll deploy as a team in the next event. We're doing that across a number of different specialties: applied public health, mental health, as I've stated. We have what's called a HAMR team, which is a standing full-time emergency response, our first responder team, that will respond. There are actually two of the teams that are on the books today, with a third in the future. These teams of about 100 individuals are specially trained to be our first incident command on the ground when an event occurs, and they become the backbone upon which a number of other agencies can respond and deliver medical and health assets.
In this segment, I'd like to talk about pandemic flu planning at the federal level. Tell us a little bit about this planning and preparedness for the pandemic flu. And this is one of your major focus areas, isn't it?
It is, actually. And the president, the secretary, the Homeland Security Council, in fact, every agency has recognized that pandemic influenza is a real threat. We don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen tomorrow or it could happen 100 years from now. But regardless, we'd recognize that if we're unprepared when it happens, there'll be so much more damage done to our society and to people's lives. So preparation has become a very important part of what we do. Pandemic influenza preparedness in general is led by the Department of Health and Human Services, at least all the health and medical aspects of pandemic influenza preparedness. But it's important to note that unlike, or rather perhaps like, every other natural disaster, the consequences aren't just health-related. There are consequences on the infrastructure of our communities. There are consequences to society itself, the well-being, the security, the economy, the education of our children. And a pandemic, like a hurricane or an earthquake, affects all of those areas as well. So even though we, the Department of Health and Human Services, focus in on the health and the public health aspects of a pandemic, we're working alongside the Department of Homeland Security and the HSC, the Homeland Security Council at the White House, to make sure that all of those other areas are also being given attention through other departments.
Well, let's look a little bit more closely at what you folks are doing at the federal level. Give us some of the details on how HHS is working to improve the preparedness at the federal level.
Well, it goes into some broad categories that I think are pretty important. The first is we recognize, and these are general concepts, we recognize that planning and exercising are two different things. It's not enough to have a plan. We're also pushing to have local communities, states, indeed individuals and companies, to have them begin exercising plans. In fact, we fully recognize that the first wave of plans that spread across the nation, that kind of tie together across the nation, will be improved by the subsequent wave of exercises that occur. And we're hoping that with time, no two plans will stay the same, that they'll change over time. The other big area that's important are the federal responsibilities. So in addition to this notion of getting everyone to plan and exercise, we also recognize that the federal government has some unique responsibilities. For example, making sure that we have a vaccine. No other sector of society can do that for us. We are the ones that have to assure that the marketplace and industry are doing the taking the steps and going through the evolution that they need to in order to assure us that we will have a vaccine for a pandemic within 6 months of a pandemic occurring. That's our goal. We're also working very closely through the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to make sure that we have strong surveillance systems. Now, surveillance systems serve two major goals. The first is to identify as early as possible when a pandemic has occurred. And when it arrives in our nation, or should it, God forbid, start in our nation, be there as quickly as possible. I'll come back to this in just a second. But the second, probably even more important role of surveillance is to be able to monitor and to have a sense of situational awareness when a pandemic is here. How fast is it burning through communities? How fast are we burning through our resources? How are our interventions holding up and impacting the pandemic? Just to come back to that first point, however, early identification of a pandemic. It's really about giving us an opportunity to see if we can stop it before it really begins to start. And the notion of a spark in the brush. If you get to that spark just as it happens, before it becomes a full-blown forest fire, and stamp it out with all your assets and with all your strength, you might actually be able to stop a pandemic right at its very beginning. We recognize, however, that given the vastness of our world and the fact that anywhere that a pandemic starts, if you're not there at the beginning, the entire world is placed at risk. It's our sense is that we probably won't be there when the pandemic first starts, and therefore our second step is to make sure we're able to slow it down as it spreads through our nation.
What about the overall pandemic preparedness and planning within Secretary Leavitt's office? Can you give us a little insight into that?
Yeah, he's made it a critically important part of his organization. He has 10 major priorities that he's working on today, and pandemic influenza preparedness is number one or two. He's organized in such a way that there are two. I'll be straight up. Every aspect of HHS is involved in pandemic influenza preparedness, whether it's the Centers for Disease Control, FDA, or NIH. Everyone is fully engaged. But within the office of the secretary, there isn't one person that I can think of that doesn't touch on pandemic influenza preparedness every single day. And there are two main offices that are dedicated to it, one being the Office of Public Health Emergency Preparedness, which has now recently been renamed by an act of Congress, which was signed into law by the president. It's now called the Office of Preparedness and Response. That's a dedicated office dedicated to all things bioterrorism, all things homeland security, all things public health and medical emergency. But I am also personally involved in pandemic influenza preparedness. Mm-hmm. I have the privilege and the honor of serving as the chair of the Pandemic Influenza Executive Committee, a committee of all of the Secretary's key leaders that meets on a weekly basis and sometimes much more often than that to update and advise the Secretary on how we as a nation are doing in our preparedness.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the event of a pandemic or the activation of the National Response Plan, HHS has a critical role to manage the public health and medical response and support the Department of Homeland Security in domestic incident management and federal coordination. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
Our partnership with the Department of Homeland Security and as I've said, with all the other agencies of the federal government and with state governments, I must say, has actually been wonderful to see in the area of pandemic influenza preparedness. We just recently completed a tour of every single state and indeed some of our territories and some of the tribal nations where we actually took teams of senior leaders of both HHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and in many cases the Department of Agriculture. On occasion, other departments would join us, Commerce and Education. And we went out and visited with governors, leaders, mayors of each of the big cities, all of the states, and as I've said, many of the territories and tribal nations. And we went and we would have sit-down meetings where we would plan or we would discuss plans for pandemic influenza preparedness. And then we would go out and speak with the larger community in that particular area, whether it be a state or a city. So it's been a very engaging process. We meet, I think, almost on a daily basis with the Department of Homeland Security on a number of issues, pandemic influenza being one of them. I'll just highlight here, I know I'm going a little long on this answer, but I'll just highlight that we really see pandemic influenza preparedness as being a part of the all-hazard approach to preparedness. We believe strongly and fundamentally that you can't maintain over the next 30 years, over the next 100 years, a separation of the hazards with different plans for each one. One of the ways that you sustain an approach, a prepared nation, so to speak, is to build every new threat or every emerging threat into your all-hazards plans. Once you've identified the threat, once you've defined what it is and what it takes to respond to it, there has to be a process where you then integrate that response into your all-hazards plan. So it's fine to stand it off to one side while you're standing up. But once you've defined what the threat is and you have a plan and it's exercised, it needs to be built back into the all-hazards approach to planning just to assure our grandchildren that it's going to be there for them when they grow up. So we're in the process of trying to do that as well. And Homeland Security and the Department of Health and Human Services have really forged a strong all-hazards approach together to the emerging threats of this millennium.
The last section in this segment, I want to talk a little bit with you about your plans for risk communication strategies. Can you tell us a little bit about that within HHS?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate. The people of our nation have been very fortunate. Congress took pandemic influenza planning very, very seriously. They spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the key pieces were. We've talked about the making sure we have a vaccine. We've talked about surveillance. We've talked about planning. They also helped make sure that we had a strong risk communication strategy and funded that strategy. So our Office of Public Relations and Media downstairs, headed up by Assistant Secretary Susie DeFrancis, is responsible for coordinating the efforts of all of the agencies within HHS in the field of risk communication. In the not-too-distant future, there will be PSAs, public service announcements, that will go out to the world that remind people of the importance of avoiding disease, avoiding the spread of illness when they're sick, and specifically tries to get the nation to, or individuals, to build plans to all hazards and to pandemic influenza. We're also working, as you can probably expect, very closely with other agencies, CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and we have a wonderful website that I would urge your listeners to, if they haven't already visited, to go to, because it provides them not only information on what is pandemic influenza and what are the preparedness efforts of the federal government, state governments, and others, but it also has modules on there that allow you to see the and learn about the key tenets of risk communication and what might you be called upon to do, and how might you strengthen your part of the world in terms of risk communication. Mm-hmm. Pandemicflu.gov is the name of the website, www.pandemicflu, and that's one word, .gov.
In this segment, I'd like to hear your views on the need for a robust public health infrastructure to meet the pandemic challenge. And I want to focus our thoughts and discussion on the way ahead, particularly in the way for the federal, state, and local coordinated partnership. As I said before, the state and local first responders and first receivers are our core audience, and I think they're going to be very interested to hear your views on this partnership that you all are developing.
Although it's a partnership, in my opinion, not all the partners are equal. I'm of the firm belief, given my experience in the past and my work today, that the piece that needs to be strengthened absolutely the most, because it is where pandemic influenza and any other hazard will hit the most, is the local end. In other words, although local, state, and federal government should work together in partnership, it's pretty clear to me that it should be the local partner that we try to strengthen the most over time. All emergencies are local. All emergency responses are local. State and federal work should be in support of that local effort. I see that happening today on the issue of pandemic influenza. I see cities and counties and local communities stepping up in a very big way. School districts working hard to make sure their system is ready for a pandemic. Local companies building pandemic plans into their larger annual forecasts and annual strategies. It's very pleasing to see what's happening. There is a need to do more, but we've come a long way.
Now, we've heard many times recently that planning for the pandemic begins from the bottom up, and you've just sort of emphasized that. Can you tell us a little bit about the ongoing activities in the relationships that you're forging with the state and locals to enhance the preparedness? Now, you talked a little bit about the schools.
Yeah.
Elaborate a little bit further on that.
Right now, we're working on the along a track that allows communities to get information on how to prepare that is specific to specific sectors in a given community. So, for example, if you were to visit www.pandemicflu.gov, our website, the government, federal government's website, you'd see a long list of what we call checklists. These are guidelines for how specific areas can plan and prepare for a pandemic, whether that be the emergency medical system of a community, the faith-based sector within a community, churches, which would be faith-based, have begun to step up and put together plans today for how they might respond in a pandemic. But we're also working very closely, as you can well imagine, with schools, with companies. We've been working quite a bit with the travel industry and with law enforcement to try and make sure that at the local level, each section of that community has a sense of what it would do in general, but what it would do specific to that mm-hmm. particular area. So that's one area where Congress has funded preparedness, especially for a pandemic, in a very real way, a very tangible way. And we're trying to filter that money down to the local communities by having it go to states and then from states on to counties and into local communities. And we're using the states as a conduit because the states help us assure that across a given jurisdiction there's coordination. We recognize that no one community is going to be able to stand alone in a pandemic, and that there's going to have to be this need for communities to stand with each other, sharing assets, sharing resources where they can, and working with each other to get through a pandemic. So there's a lot of work going on with the local communities, but I would say that probably the single most important part of that work is this notion of planning and preparedness at the sector level.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a little bit about financial resources. The financial assistance that HHS provides states, how is it delineating areas for mutual cooperation between the federal government and the states as you're jointly preparing for the potential for a future pandemic?
Well, I think I should state the obvious. It's not HHS helping communities. These are taxpayer dollars, and it's coming from Congress and being appropriated and is going back to the communities from which it came to help them in their preparedness. So far, Congress has provided us the ability to put $350 million just into planning and preparedness at the state and local level. I understand that in the current pending budget, there are more monies, approximately the same amount, potentially, that would also go out to the states mm-hmm. and communities for that same purpose, to enhance their ability to write plans and to push planning all the way down to almost a family and individual level, but to exercise those plans as well. But I think it's critically important that we recognize that pandemic planning, as I've said, is a part of all hazards planning. And from a health and medical standpoint, what that means is that we need to have a strong and robust local public health infrastructure. And I'm proud to say that our administration and Congress, since September 11th and the subsequent anthrax attack with which I was associated in Florida, that we've actually put out $6.9 billion, billion with a B, into public health preparedness. It initially went into public health to help strengthen their bioterrorism preparedness and has filtered out each year across the nation since 2001 into state and local public health infrastructure. That same infrastructure, including hospitals, is the infrastructure that we will need in a pandemic. So that entire investment, $6.9 billion since 2001, is a part of the larger pandemic influenza preparedness plan.
What's your take on how the Commission Corps is working with the state and local officials for the pandemic planning?
Yeah, we, as you can well imagine, being that we are integrated into a number of service delivery systems, the Indian Health Service Delivery System, which stretches out across our nation, the Federal Bureau of Prisons that stretches out across the nation, we provide healthcare services in all of those areas, that we'll have very real responsibilities in a pandemic, just caring for those constituencies. But in addition to that, our public health service officers work at the Centers for Disease Control and the Epidemic Intelligence Service, Investigative Service, where we go out and investigate epidemics, and indeed at FDA and at NIH, where we have researchers in uniform working 24/7 on trying to develop cures to disease, new antivirals, for example, and in trying to develop vaccines for disease. I'm pretty certain that every single one of our officers in a pandemic would be fully engaged in the fight mm-hmm. against a pandemic. It is important to note that in a pandemic, we expect every community across our nation at some point to be facing to be struggling under the burden of that pandemic. Mm-hmm. Indeed, we fully expect that most of the communities will be doing so simultaneously. The federal government, as much as we will do everything in our power to assist every community, it's entirely unlikely that we're going to be able to serve to meet the needs of every community simultaneously. We're going to have to move our assets to where they are most needed on any given day. We're going to have a prioritization system that allows us to be there when people need us, and then to move on to those areas that need us more when the time comes. But having said that, I think it is important that every community therefore have an ability to stand up its own response as quickly as possible if a pandemic occurs.
Now, you had a series of in-state pandemic planning summits earlier last year. What are some of the key report outs that came out of those?
They were actually wonderful events. For many states, they were the first time governors had stood up and engaged actively at the very front in the fight against pandemic influenza. So at a minimum, these were these summits allowed us to engage the highest level of government in any given state. But we were also struck by the fact that in many of these summits, where there were hundreds of thousands of people overall, in any given summit, perhaps 1,000 or 500 people would come and listen to the discussions, how diverse the rooms typically were. They were filled with housewives, soccer moms, teachers, faith-based leaders, policemen, and in some cases just citizens who had walked in off the street. And so we began, I think, in each of the states to engage their broader communities at these summits. We also, and I think this is very important, we also started to present a single unified voice to the citizenry. At these summits, we would have local, state, and federal officials standing on the podium, speaking the same language, and speaking to the importance of pandemic influenza preparedness. Clearly, if a pandemic occurs, we're going to have that same visual and that same single voice as we speak to community. So that was important as well. Feedback since then has been that the planning has gone beyond the state level. It's now being pushed down into local communities and into companies and into school systems, as I've said. And we like to think that the summits helped that happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the way of technical assistance that the department is providing to the states, that's in the area of planning and logistical support and assistance to the state and local health departments. That also includes the health care agency and hospitals, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It does. We have the Health Resources and Services Administration, commonly called HRSA, which is one of our HHS agencies here in the department. And over the last few years, HRSA has funded hospital preparedness for public health emergencies. In other words, helping hospitals figure out how they would manage surge for demand, whether it was caused by a pandemic or by smallpox or by anthrax or some other disease. We recognize that hospitals around the nation need to be prepared, need to be able to surge up when demand occurs. We've also gotten communities to recognize that the notion of a hospital simply being four walls with a roof probably needs to be expanded for the concept of a pandemic, because there might be so much need and so many patients. The notion of a hospital simply being within the four walls of that building perhaps is not quite the best approach in some communities. Many hospitals have therefore reached into their community and are now part of the planning for wards to be built in schools or in hospitals or in empty buildings where the care that they deliver within the hospital would now be taken out into the community. Other hospitals have begun to work locally to set up systems whereby people could be cared for at home by the staff and the expertise that's present in the hospital. So rather than surging into the hospital, there's this notion that they might have to surge out into the community. That's happening quite a bit, and we're pleased by that. I'll just end by saying, the Secretary and I have both said on many occasions that one of the areas that worries us the most is this notion of surge capacity, the ability to assure any given community that its healthcare needs can be met in that community if a pandemic occurs. It's quite clear to us that depending on the type of pandemic, some communities might be overwhelmed if it were to happen today. You know, there are very mild pandemics that, like the one in 1968, very few of us even remember the fact that there was a pandemic in 1968. And although there was a surge in the number of patients, it didn't overwhelm the health system. Whereas a 1918-like pandemic can probably be expected, if it were to happen today, to to, quite frankly, overwhelm many, not all, but many of our health systems around the nation. Because of that, we think it's critically important that we continue to work on surge, that we continue to encourage in the planning and exercising innovative ways for providing an increase in service for a short period of time. It's not something that's really amenable to building parallel systems of hospitals that lie fallow, that lie mothballed for years and years and years, because the key issue isn't really space or equipment. The key issue is people, you know, first responders, emergency room workers, nurses, and doctors. There needs to be some way for us to surge up quickly and then return back to our baseline after the pandemic is over, a concept that we're hoping occurs within 6 to 12 months, you know, this notion that it's a temporary spike. But I'm very pleased by some of the things I'm seeing happening in communities in this regard.
You talked earlier about the importance of the federal activity in vaccine supply. So let's talk a little bit about that. How is HHS going to ensure the effective access to vaccine and treatment?
We have a two-step process. Just to simplify it, we recognize that there is a need for us to have some kind of vaccine on hand today that allows us to, so to speak, prime our system prior to a pandemic occurring. But we also recognize that we're going to need to have a vaccine for every U.S. resident if a pandemic actually occurs. Today, we do have some vaccine stockpiled for H5N1, the avian influenza. Now, it's important for people to realize that the next pandemic may not be caused by H5N1. It could be caused by some other virus. And we may not know that that virus is out there today. It could just suddenly appear out of nowhere. But we do look at H5N1, the avian influenza that we see going around the world, and we realize that it could become the next pandemic. And so we've maintained a stockpile to try and assure that if it does, that we have enough vaccine on hand, H5N1 vaccine, to at least offer some protection to our first responders and our frontline workers. Ultimately, however, we also recognize that it's entirely unlikely that any vaccine that we prepare and stockpile prior to a pandemic will offer us the kind of protection that we need after a pandemic occurs. And this is because for a pandemic to occur, the virus has to change in some fundamental way. The H5N1 virus that's out there today, for which we have a vaccine today, that virus has to change in some very real and tangible way before it becomes a pandemic. And if that change is done in such a way that it also changes it so that our vaccine doesn't work, then we'll have nothing. So we have a system whereby we have invested in science, invested in trying to find new ways to make vaccine, invested in industry, that the vaccine industry, to try and get it to grow and to strengthen its ability to manufacture rapidly large amounts of vaccine. And our goal is to make sure that every U.S. resident has access to vaccine within 6 months of a pandemic virus first emerging. Now, as I've said, we don't have a pandemic virus today. But if H5N1 makes that shift, makes that mutation, that evolution, and becomes a pandemic virus, then we'll turn on the switches quickly, and hopefully within 6 months have a vaccine for everyone. Today we have about 6 million doses of, we've stockpiled, rather, about 6 million doses of H5N1 vaccine. In preparation for a pandemic, if it comes from H5N1, the virus.
Now, the statistic about treating over 25% of the U.S. population, providing enough antiviral drugs and other medical supplies, is that what you're referring to as far as the 6 million doses? Or
No. When I talk about the 5.9 or 6 million courses of H5N1 vaccine, I'm actually referring to a vaccination, a shot that you can be given that will protect you, prevent you from getting that infection. The 25% number that was discussed, let me just restate. Our goal is to have a vaccine for 100% yeah. of our nation. And everyone living within our borders, 100%. That's our goal there. Mm-hmm. The 25% number that's been used relates to antivirals.
Right.
Now, just very quick math here. It's expected that in the next pandemic, and this comes from the fact that it's been true in the last three pandemics, that about 30% of our population will get infected. 30% infected. Of the 30% that gets infected during a pandemic, and this happened in 1918, in 1957, and in 1968, all three pandemics shared this notion. Roughly 30% of the population, it's actually a little less, roughly 30% of the population got infected. We know that not everyone who gets infected needs treatment. And indeed, it's actually a rather small proportion of those who get infected actually go on to require full-blown treatment. But to be safe, we thought it best that we keep on hand enough treatment for about 25% of our population. Mm-hmm. And that should mean that of those that get infected, that 30%, they get infected, a mm-hmm. portion of them are going to require treatment with antivirals. And we hope to have more antivirals than we'll need in order to treat people. I'll just add this. When that number was first thrown out, there was actually a shortage of Tamiflu. Although we had lots of other antivirals, mm-hmm. Tamiflu was deemed at that point to be the one most likely to work if a pandemic occurred. Today, because of our investment in industry and because of the rapid surge that industry has gone through, there's no longer a shortage of Tamiflu. Indeed, we're told by the manufacturers of Tamiflu that even though we're pursuing this strategy of stockpiling 25% of the nation's, or enough to cover 25% of the nation, that indeed the manufacturers are manufacturing every year in the U.S., 80 million courses of Tamiflu, which is roughly 25% of the nation. In other words, mm-hmm. we'll have 25% in a stockpile, mm-hmm. but throughout a pandemic, we'll be manufacturing enough each year mm-hmm. to treat 25% as well. So I'm not, at least for Tamiflu, I sense that we'll have more than we need mm-hmm. to take care of the problem, depending on the kind of pandemic that we have.
Finally, Dr. Agwunobi, let's look briefly at your international pandemic preparedness activities. Tell us a little bit about some of the key activities that you're involved in to enhance the international readiness.
Just very quickly, our doctrine, as I've stated, is to try and be there when a spark occurs so that we can snuff it out before it becomes a full-blown forest fire that then spreads to the U.S. So we're developing partnerships, both bilateral partnerships with individual nations around the world and a much larger multilateral partnership through the World Health Organization, where we're a major player in trying to improve preparedness at the global level. It primarily involves helping developing nations in Southeast Asia and others, to improve their surveillance systems so that when that spark occurs, there's someone there and we notice that it's happened, and to improve their lab and capacity, laboratory capacity, their testing capacity, their technical know-how. And we're doing that unilaterally, or so rather bilaterally, as I've said, with at least 40 different nations around the world. We've given them grants, we've sent them technical guidance, we've worked with them to improve their surveillance system. But we're also working through the World Health Organization as they try to strengthen the entire globe's ability to take on and respond to a pandemic. Of note is the fact that we've spent, whether it be through CDC, FDA, our Office of Global Health Affairs, or the NIH, HHS has actually helped push into the system more than the global preparedness system, more than $200 million over the last few years alone. And we expect to continue working with each of these nations, whether it be Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, China, and Japan. We've worked in Nigeria, in Africa. We've worked with Turkey. We were a part of the investigative team that worked in Indonesia during recent outbreaks there, Egypt, and in other settings. And the point is that We believe strongly that if a pandemic happens anywhere in the world, the threat is everywhere in the world, and that it's in our best interest here at home to be active participants in trying to protect the rest of the world, especially as it relates to a pandemic.
Now, as far as Southeast Asia, you're expanding clinical trials there, correct?
We are. We are. We're actually working with researchers through our NIH, National Institute of Health, with researchers in different countries, especially in Southeast Asia, whether it be Vietnam and China and Japan. I know we're working very closely with them. We sense that the scientific community at the global level needs to rally around the cause and indeed have stepped up and are rallying around research that might lead us to better tests, research that might lead us to better vaccines. What's very important is this notion that we should have global access to all of the different strains of virus that appear today and in the future, so that all the scientists of the world can quickly begin to focus their research on new strains of viruses as soon as they appear. So this notion of scientific collaboration, we believe, is fundamentally important to a globe prepared to fight any kind of disease outbreak, but especially a pandemic.
Now, the last question I'd like to ask, you'd mentioned your work with Indonesia and Vietnam, et cetera. Which of the currently affected countries, where are they that you're implementing the rapid outbreak response? And can you tell us a little bit about how that's going?
We've done quite a bit of work in Indonesia, as I've stated, but also in Thailand and in Nigeria. And in Turkey, we're beginning to work very closely with their local public health infrastructure with technical guidance. We actually have people on the ground. We already have two or three people out there now working with different countries, one in Thailand, as I've stated. We have another eight that we've hired that are going to be deployed across the world to different countries. And we're going to try and get them to where we sense the pandemic is most acute, and we'll move assets around the world as the H5N1 avian influenza epidemic changes and spreads. Today we have three, I think, on the ground in Southeast Asia, primarily Laos, Cambodia, and I think Thailand, one perhaps in Vietnam, and another eight about to go out into other countries.
Great. Well, Dr. Agwunobi, this has been wonderful, most informative, and I thank you very much for your time and for your service to our country.
Thank you very much, John, and I want to use this opportunity to thank everyone in the field of domestic preparedness. I think it's important that we always put this in some perspective. I have three little children, 12, 10, and 8, and I thank everyone that works on domestic preparedness because I recognize that they're making this nation safer for my children and every other child that's out there, and I applaud everyone's work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness Podcast interview. Thank you for listening.